So we're going to look at this first little incident and then another one in chapter 14 after our next hymn, sort of splitting up, help the children sort of concentrate. We'll look at this story together. Here in this account, we have this king who's described for us. More of his son, the prince, we'll see in the next chapter. And in some ways, you kind of feel sorry for Saul in the situation he finds himself now. He's in a very difficult scenario. He's seriously outnumbered. At the beginning of the chapter, we're told that Saul might have had 3,000 men. And yet, we're told that when the Philistines gather together, that they've got 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people as numerous as the sand on the seashore. So they poked the bear. They attacked the Philistines. And now the Philistines gather for battle, and Israel is seriously outnumbered. And the people are frightened, and they start going into hiding. They hide away in caves. Some of them even leave the land of Israel and go next door to the land of Gad and Gilead. We're also told in verse 8 and 9 that the people were there with Saul, and they were afraid. They were frightened of this coming battle that there might be. And the army was deserting. Every day, more and more troops left Saul's camp and slunk away because they were too afraid of the battle that might develop. Later on in chapter 13, in verse 17, we're told that there were three companies of Philistines raiding behind the Israelite front lines. So the Philistines had already sent in some invaders, and they were sort of circling round behind them. They had these raiding parties. They were already outmaneuvered, even before the battle had really begun. In verse 19, we're told they had a shortage of weapons as well. What's happening all this time? There's this pretty bad scenario developing. It looks down like there's going to be some showdown now to some pretty nasty battle that is going to happen. And what's Saul doing? In verse 8, we're told he was waiting. He was waiting for Samuel. That's what he has to do. He has some instructions. He waited 7 days, verse 8, according to the time set by Samuel. So somehow he must have known, we're not told all of the details of this, that Saul was meant to go to Gilgal and wait for 7 days like Samuel had told him. There's a curious little verse back in chapter 10 and verse 8, which kind of now comes across a bit like a prophecy. But you might not have noticed it at the time. In 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 8, Samuel said to Saul much earlier on, "You shall go down before me to Gilgal, and surely I will come down to offer burnt offerings and make sacrifices of peace offerings. 7 days you shall wait, and I will come to you and show you what you should do." And so Samuel said that to Saul a long time before. But that seems to relate to this situation, doesn't it? It happens in the same place, it's about the same time, they've got to wait 7 days. Samuel's going to come and make the offerings and give him instructions. And so that seems the background for what's happening here in chapter 13. Whether Saul was told this, repeated this again, we don't know for certain. But he does know he's meant to wait 7 days, and he's meant to wait for Samuel. And yet, Samuel doesn't come when Saul expects him. Maybe it is now the seventh day. And, you know, Saul's up at the crack of dawn saying, "Right, come on, I've waited 7 days. Where is he? Where is Samuel?" And he checks his watch and he waits again and again. And the minutes go past and the hours go past. And he thinks, "Oh, Samuel's forgotten. He's getting old. He's forgotten, he said, he'll come in 7 days. And I've got to do something about it." You can almost imagine Saul sort of pacing around, can't you? And he's there waiting these days, and the people are trembling and so on. And in the end, Saul goes, "Right, I've got to do it. Bring me the burnt offerings and the peace offerings." And so he did it. He took these sacrifices and he offered them. And then, of course, Samuel arrives. Verse 10, now it happened, as soon as he'd finished presenting the burnt offering, that Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him that he might greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? What have you done? He was meant to wait. He was meant to wait, and Samuel would come and make those sacrifices. And Samuel was going to give him some instructions as to what to do, presumably about the battle that there was going to be. God was going to tell them what to do. And Saul thinks Samuel's late, and he does it. He does the sacrifice himself, and he doesn't wait for any instructions, and he doesn't get any instructions. Saul gives his excuses. Verse 11, now the people were scattering, and you didn't come the day you said. And the Philistines have gathered at Michmash, and I thought they'd come and attack me at Gilgal. So I had to do it. I felt compelled to do it. And Samuel says to him, verse 13, you have done foolishly. And in verse 14, he says, now your kingdom will not continue. His family line wouldn't continue. And we might think for a minute that that all sounds a bit harsh, doesn't it? We can understand maybe a little bit. We can feel a bit sympathetic towards Saul. I think, oh, he's in a really difficult position here. And Samuel comes, and does Samuel fly off the handle and say, look how foolish you've been. And then he pronounces this judgment that Saul's kingdom will not continue anymore. I think that's a bit of an overreaction, isn't it? Now, Saul just jumped the gun a bit. What's the big deal? And why does that mean that Saul's son Jonathan can't become king later on, and other people who might come in his family in the years to follow? But here, we're shown the foolish king. And he's the first character we're going to think about this morning. Saul, King Saul, the foolish king. That's what God says about him. Now, we might think that's a bit of an overreaction. We might feel some sympathy towards Saul, but perhaps we kind of need to think then through, why would God say such a thing? What is it that he did that was so foolish? Perhaps to us, Saul's actions seemed quite reasonable. But what does he do here in this situation? He takes over the role of being a priest, doesn't he? And he offers these sacrifices. It sounds like he does it. He might ask a priest who was there with him to do it. But either way, it was Samuel's job to do that, to offer these burnt offerings, these peace offerings that are mentioned. That was Samuel's job. That was the priest's job. And here Saul takes over. That wasn't his job to do. It was a specially task that God had given to Samuel and to others and so on, to be priests and offer sacrifices. And the other thing, of course, that Samuel was a prophet, and Samuel was going to come with instructions. Samuel was going to tell Saul what to do. Maybe there was this master plan that God had for the battle. And God was going to come and give the instructions to Samuel, and Samuel would give them to Saul about how God was going to do something in this battle. And Saul can't be bothered to wait for the instructions. God might have had the most incredible plan for this battle, but Saul can't be bothered to wait for the instructions. Instead, he disobeys God. Again, we might sort of think through what's going on here, and you think, oh yeah, he's outnumbered and he's poorly equipped and he's outmaneuvered. His troops are frightened and they're deserting, and every day the army's getting smaller, and God's prophet seems to delay. Every day it seems to be getting worse. And Saul thinks to himself, I've got to do something. But he doesn't do what God said. He didn't do what God commanded. God commanded to wait 7 days and then do what Samuel would say. And we're told that twice. Verse 13, we're told, you've acted foolishly, you have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. Again, end of verse 14, your kingdom will not continue because you've not kept what the Lord commanded you. That's what his foolishness was. That's what his mistake was. He didn't do what God commanded. Saul here seems to suffer from what I might call unbelieving mathematics. Maybe it's been a while. The kids have been on their holidays now for a couple of weeks. Can you remember some maths? Hopefully it'll all come flooding back to you in a couple of weeks' time when you're back in school and you sit down in a lesson and think, oh no, I haven't added up anything in weeks. I've forgotten how to do sums. Well, here we see Saul had a problem with his sums, a problem with his mathematics. It was unbelieving. He looked at the challenging situation. He thought about the various factors involved. His army was smaller than the enemy's. The enemy were outmaneuvering him. He had a shortage of weapons. He looked at all of these factors involved and thought to himself, this is impossible. I can't win this. And the situation's getting worse. And God says I've got to wait. And God says I've got to do what he says. But I don't think that's going to work. I've got to do something else. But it's not just Saul. He thought about the situation, and he thought it all through in his own head, and it led then to unbelief and disobedience. And we might look at what Saul did and say that seems so logical, so understandable, so reasonable. But sin often does seem that, doesn't it? It's not just Saul who's foolish like this. But we face our own challenging situations. We're probably not often on the battlefield like Saul was. But we're there in a situation and we look at it and it's challenging. And we think to ourselves, oh, there's a way out of this. If I were to lie. Or if I were to steal. Or if I were to swear, or whatever it might be, or if I were to get angry. We think through, and often we think, oh, I've got to, God would understand. I've got to do this, and it seems, it's the logical thing I've got to do in this situation. We make our excuses, don't we? We try and reason things out, and make it seem that we've got no other option, and we've got to do this, or whatever. God asks Saul, what have you done? What have you done? I was gonna send my prophet and my priest to you. He was gonna make a sacrifice. I was gonna tell you what to do. I was gonna do something in this situation. And you've jumped the gun, you've disobeyed. And what have you done? That, of course, is the same question that somebody else was very famously asked in the beginning of the Bible. Adam and Eve. They sinned. And perhaps again, you might think through in their minds, their sin, their disobedience seems quite logical. We've got some of their logic, haven't we, in Genesis chapter 3, that they saw the fruit of the tree and it seemed nice to eat. And it looked like the kind of thing that would make you wise. There's their logic, thinking things through. And they eat of the fruit that God tells them not to. And God comes and says, what have you done? What have you done? You disobeyed the commandment I gave. God says to Saul here in these verses, you're foolish. You should have trusted me. You should have known that I know best. You should have listened to my instructions. But here in this chapter, we find Saul, and we also find a bit of a mirror, don't we? That so often we can do the same kind of thing. We can be caught between a rock and a hard place, and we think, oh, everything's too difficult, and we make our excuses, and we sin and disobey. And God says to us, what did you do that for? Why didn't you trust me? Why didn't you listen to my instructions? I would have helped you in that situation if you'd only asked. And yet we think we know best. We see here in these verses this foolish king. And he can't be king anymore, God says. And his family can't be king after him. And God has a new king in mind. He says in verse 14, the Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart. And the Lord has chosen him to be commander of his people. Saul couldn't be king anymore. His family couldn't continue in the royal family. Because God's got a new king, a man after his own heart. Someone who he loved and has chosen. Someone who's got a character like his, a heart like his. God is thinking of David, but he's also thinking of Jesus, his son, who would be the king after his own heart in the most amazing way. And when we think about this situation and we think about Saul's sin and ours too, we have a king who was wise. God had chosen his son and he sent him to be the king and saviour. And we read in Hebrews chapter 5, verse 7, in the days of his, Jesus' flesh and Jesus' life, he offered up prayers and supplication with cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and was heard because of his godly fear. Though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things he suffered. And having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him. We have a king. Even though he's the Son of God, he learned obedience. That's where Saul went wrong, wasn't it? He disobeyed. That's where every one of us goes wrong too, me included. We disobey. We think we know best. We choose an easy way out. We sin and we go against God's ways. But God sent his Son who learned obedience, who did it every day. So he could become the author of eternal salvation. When we look at the story of Saul, we're like him. We're with him in the mess of our sin. But Jesus, God sent his son Jesus, who could bring eternal salvation to those who disobey like we do. We'll think a little bit more about that in a moment. But let's pause and sing another together. So the second character we're going to look at here is that of Jonathan. And look here just for a moment at his astonishing words that he says in verse 6. He says to his armor bearer, his wingman, you know, they were going to go into battle together. They probably trained together and so on as well. He says, let's go. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. That's Jonathan's logic. Let's go. And we'll see about this Philistine garrison that's up there, this camp where the Philistines are. And we'll go up. And Jonathan acts in faith. He wonders to himself, maybe God could use us. He doesn't know it for sure. We can try, we can go up, and it may be that God will act for us, that God will help us in this fight. Because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that there's only the two of us, Jonathan and his bodyguard. There's nothing can stop God from saving. God can save his people from the Philistines. And he might use us. We don't know unless we try. Here we see the mathematics of faith. We were saying earlier on that Saul did his sums and came to one conclusion. Let's just think it through. You can try and do some math if you want. Saul thought to himself, we've got a huge enemy, as numerous as the sand on the seashore. We've got a small army, only 6,000 men. And the army's getting smaller every day, as people desert it. There's not enough weapons to go round. And so, Saul decided the situation was hopeless. It was hopeless, and it was only getting worse. And so he chose to disobey. That's what Saul thought. That's what we've been looking at in chapter 13. That's how his maths worked. But now Jonathan does the same sort of sums and comes to a different result. Jonathan looked around and saw this huge enemy. He's even spying out an enemy camp. He knows what's in there. He knows they have a small army. He knows too that men are deserting and there's not enough weapons. And so he decides to launch an attack with just the two of them. And yet he is hopeful. He's hopeful that they could launch this attack. Why? Was he some phenomenal ninja? No, his hope is that God can save. He doesn't believe that he and his bodyguard are some superhuman heroes, but he believes that God can save. And so he and his bodyguards decide to launch this little attack. And they devise this test. They're going to pop up at the bottom, perhaps, of this hill. And they're going to see what the Philistines say. And if the Philistines stay there, they will. But if the Philistines say, come up, then they certainly will do that. They'll go up and attack. And so that's what they do. They pop out. The Philistines see them. The Philistines make a joke about the Hebrews who are pumping out of the little holes where they've been hiding. And they say, come up and we'll show you something. Maybe it's kind of, come up and we'll teach you a lesson, say the Philistines. And Jonathan says to his armor bearer, come up after me. For the Lord has delivered them. The Lord has saved us. The Lord has delivered them into the hands of Israel. And so they attack. Maybe last week at camp, some of you went to the climbing centre in Derby. Maybe others have been climbing before and been to various places where you can try out your skill climbing up rocks and so on in that. Here in this chapter, we read in verse 4 that there was this rocky pass, a ravine perhaps. And Jonathan thought about going over to the Philistine garrison. There were two sharp rocks. They're called Bozez and Seneh. One means slippery and one means thorny. In their sort of colloquial language. So, Jonathan has this plan. He says, we could climb up that ravine. There's two rocks. One on either side, perhaps the ravine goes up the middle. Are there this pass between the rocks? One rock is called Bozez, slippery. And the other one's called thorny. Which one are you going to pick? Or are you going to climb up the crack between the two? I don't know exactly. Aren't there thoughts here? One's called slippery. It's a sharp rock, we're told. The other's thorny. Perhaps there's plants growing on it in the cracks and so on, but they're not the kind of cracks you can put your hand in to lever yourself up on the rocks, because there's all these thorns around and so on. Wow, there they are. And Jonathan steps out in faith, and they climb up and they launch this surprise attack, and they climb up, Jonathan on his hands and knees. And he attacks this camp. And perhaps the people in the camp thought it was such an inaccessible, impenetrable place that they weren't bothering to stand guard and so on. And so they get into the camp and launch this surprise attack. And 20 people are killed of the Philistine soldiers. And the story carries on that there's trembling in the camp. And the Philistines start fleeing out of this camp that they've made. And going off in different directions. And people of the others of the Israelites see what's happening in this situation. God saves Israel. We're told in verse 23. Chapter 14, verse 23. So the Lord saved Israel that day. That's what Jonathan hoped would happen, wouldn't it? When he did his maths. And he thought the two of them could attack the Philistines in the hope that God could save Israel, and he could even use just the two of them to do it. And that's what happens. Just as Jonathan hoped, we can all shout hooray, or the Israelites would have done, for God saved Israel that day. Just as he hoped. But the verse carries on, or the next bit carries on, verse 24. But the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had placed the people under an oath. The Israelites were distressed on that same day because of what their king Saul had done. We'll have to look at those bits next time, of how Saul, in his foolishness, gets more foolish. And sadly, the next couple of chapters describe Saul's just descent into more and more silly things and foolish things as he goes. And the people, the other soldiers, have to rescue Jonathan. And they say this about Jonathan at the end. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So that's where I came with this second title. We thought of the foolish king, which is what God says about King Saul. But of this other character, Jonathan, we read about him. He was the one who worked with God. That's an interesting little phrase that the people use about Jonathan, their prince. He's the one who acts in faith. He works with God. He ventures out in faith. We'll leave a little bit on your worksheets out, because we haven't got time for that this morning. I'll sort of wrap round instead and just finish off looking here at Jonathan, this prince. What does he do? He's facing the same kind of situation as his dad was. He, as a prince, he was second in command. He knew all the same facts. And yet he ventures and steps out in faith. He knows the situation is not hopeless, because they have a great God, and God could save them from the Philistines. It's a little bit like those words of William Carey: attempt great things for God. That's what we see Jonathan doing, isn't it? He looked at this situation, but he considered it not to be hopeless. Instead, he decided that he was going to obey God. He was going to see, he was going to pray, he was going to see if God would act through it. And so we see him at work. And perhaps sometimes we need to think through the same thing. Maybe sometimes it is a question of math. I'm not asking whether you're good at math or not. But sometimes we can think through in the same kind of way, can't we? And we can sort of look at different situations. And it could be one involving math. It could be that we're thinking to ourselves, oh, you know, we're a bit hard up, and our work situation is pretty bleak, and the cost of living's going up. And we think to ourselves, what am I going to do? Well, perhaps I'll fiddle the tax return. Perhaps I'll just use this little loophole here and there. We are so often sinfully think, don't we, about how we're going to get a way out of something. In the situations we might be in. Oh, are we going to be those who obey and seek God's help in those things? It could be one in the church as well. Perhaps sometimes, you know, here at ABC, we might look at the church finances. Think, oh, that looks pretty bleak. Or we might look at the manpower for something or other that we want to be involved in. Think, oh dear, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how this is going to pan out. We can think of it in national terms, when we look around us and see such huge forces that seem to be working against God and his people, and the changes in laws and the things that are going on in society, and we think, oh dear, the church is so small, and maybe it won't last much longer. Are we those who look at the situations around and think that's hopeless? Or do we look in faith and say, no, no, it's hopeful, because we have a great God. And as Jonathan said there, in verse 6. Come back to it. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. The situation is never hopeless. But we have a great God, and God can save, and he can use many, or he could even use just a few. And so are we going to be those few who say to God, here I am. Would you use me? Would you help me in the situations I'm facing? Even if I do sometimes get weighed down by them and so on. Are we those who look to the Lord and ask for his help? Jonathan is a remarkable character because of course we found out in chapter 13 he's the prince who will never become king, isn't he? He's never going to become king. And he knows it. Comes up a lot later on in the story. But he's happy to serve. He's happy to serve God's kingdom. He's never going to wear a crown. But he serves God and he serves God's people. What about us? Are we those who are willing to serve God's kingdom? Knowing that we don't have a foolish king over us. No, we have a great king who gave himself for us. And so we offer ourselves in his service. A battle not against flesh and blood, not like Jonathan, but in that sense. But one that through our words, through God's words, through our witness, and through the help of his Spirit, who knows? As we went to the Ashbourne show yesterday, gave out leaflets there, as we had our outreach at the Boys Brigade camp, as we think in the months ahead, it may be the Lord will work for us. Says Jonathan, nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. We know a great God who saves. Will we be those who work with him in his service? Let's sing our last hymn.